wonder-working power in the precious...
As incredible as they seem, are not the results of mass hysteria.
You may wish to adjust the dial. You are currently tuned into the wrong station. His way lay now not forward, but back. The answers he needed would be found at Fencaster, and his journey there took him a day and a night. She haunted him most of the way, an echoing presence in the fog and woods, often unseen, but always following, following. Turn back and drink. You should turn back and drink. He barely recognized her voice sometimes, when it came to him bodiless from the rains, or out of the blackness of the woods at night. It had grown guttural and cruel. No, he repeated, often aloud and often only in his mind. There are things I have to do. She laughed at him, and when she did appear, walking on the surface of the rain, or suddenly out of the thickets in the night, her visage was grotesquely changed. Now her head was fully naked skull, elongated backwards in a spiraling snail shell. Growths of grasping coral blossomed on her bony hands like bishop's rings. And when she spoke, small, horrid arthropods swarmed amongst her yellow teeth. Why not? You think you can find some absolution here? In this place? You? No absolution. He denied it. But in his secret heart, a small voice shouted, "Yes."
"Then what? Is it the Earl's daughter, then? Am I to be replaced by Pale Colwyn in your wreckage of a heart?"
"Nothing like that," he said again, and refused her any further answer to her taunts, even when she shrieked and hurled herself against him. For all her horror, she was only shadow stuff, and burst against him into tatters of flotsam-scented fog. He made good time. Long months of wandering in the wild had made a woodsman out of him, and the mists had thinned. Now the damp hills with their ragged crowns of spruce and tamarack seemed not so dismal as before. The ways through Dimnesfen were not so hard. Only mist and fog made monsters out of that landscape. He came to Castle Fencaster before nightfall on the second day, as the gray world ran itself down into cool, wetland-scented purple dark. The ghost was still with him, reduced to a sullen presence trudging far behind. Gone were the snail horns and coral hooks. She was her painted self again, her figure glowing saffron in the spreading dark. Though the gate was indifferently guarded, he chose to slip over a derelict section of the curtain wall, using the easy handholds left by crumbling mortar. Then he was down amongst brown oaks and dark yews, in the sheltered bower of the hidden garden. Strangely, for the time of year, the dead wisteria had begun to bloom again. He took shelter beneath them, against the light rain which had begun to fall. The scent was like half-remembered perfume, and when he looked around him, the ghost was gone. Before long, he drifted off to sleep, where gray waves lapped around a chest of half-drowned stonework against a coral-colored sky. When he awoke, it was a woman's hand around his neck and a steel point resting against her thumb. "Who are you?" Her voice was a gray whisper. When he looked up, he saw hollow eyes beneath a gray-streaked tangle of ale-colored hair. "Nobody." It was an honest answer. I saw you lurking here before. It's unwise to stalk an Earl's daughter. All I need to do to have you killed is shout. Her grip tightened around his neck. Or I could do it myself. He did not resist her. Who is she? He asked. Who do you mean? But it was clear from the sudden sharpening of her gaze, from the tremor in her voice, that she knew exactly who he meant. The woman in your locket. I don't know who you mean. Who is the lathe worm? And now her eyes went wide. She took a half step back, letting the dagger fall from slack hands. It slid, point first, into the heavy turf. You've seen her? No. But tell me what you've seen. She studied him for a long moment, and it was plain by her face that she didn't like what she saw. A ragged, mud-rimed scarecrow, with a thin black beard grown up to his eyes, and black bruises under half his fingernails. He wouldn't have trusted himself, either. But in the end she spoke, because whatever she had to say was burning in her chest like a held breath. I went out riding one night, to try and find her. It had been winter, a chill night on the hoar-frosted edges of the fen. She had wrapped herself against the cold in a cloak they had once shared, rich purple, lined with umber fleece. She'd chosen it because it still smelled of her, faintly, only faintly. The moon had been full, and its touch had embroidered the frozen clouds with golden thread. Suddenly, her horse had checked its step and rolled its eyes, showing red nostrils and tossing its head. Colwyn had held the creature steady, the cold hands hard upon the reins. A slow rumble was boiling from the fog, and a sound like chainmail clashed soft amongst the shattered reeds. She held her ground, realizing with slow terror that the rumble came from the chest of some huge beast, the clashing from its scaled hide. She felt the heart drop out of her chest. Sound was on every side of her, as the creature's half-glimpsed spine scissored in coiling layers underneath the fog, encircling her and closing in. She realized she had stumbled into a trap, onto a causeway of chill-packed earth above the icy mire, with the lathe worm cutting off her entrance and her exit with its body. Instinctively, she reached for the dagger at her hip. Its blade was long and narrow, well made to pierce a robber's heart, but far too light to breach the creature's scales. And then she heard another sound to chill the blood that pounded in her neck. Her own name, spoken from the fog. It barely sounded like speech at all. It was a garbled, brutal sound, forced through cavities and pharyngeal jaws never intended to shape a human thought. Was it even her name at all? Or merely a pareidolia of sound, a ghost conjectured by a grieving mind? And now the moonlight filled a set of flat, reptilic eyes, half hidden in the fog and high gray grass. She cried out in horror, nearly losing her seat as the spine silhouette bunched and rose above her like a black wave that splinters trees and tramples over walls. But at her scream, the flat and slitted golden eyes shone wide with hate and fear, and the worm recoiled, hissing like a landslide as it flung itself backwards into the mist and glacial quag. She leaped from her horse and chased it to the water's edge, but all that could be seen was a ripple of tail spines parting dwarfish ice floes on the surface of the marsh, and making them to slowly spin. The more time passes, Colwyn said, the more certain I am that the creature said my name. And there was something else as well, a feeling I can't make sense of, as if I was in the presence of... I know I must sound insane. But to Theo, her words had the iron ring of truth. What was her name? He asked. The woman you loved. She glanced at him with wary eyes, as if she dared not admit, or dared not speak the name aloud. "Hideswith," she whispered at last. "Captain of my father's guard." "She disappeared," said Theo. "Just over a year ago? Just before the coming of the worm?" Colwyn nodded. "It's no coincidence. It's been her, Colwyn, this entire time." Though she could not bring herself to believe what he was saying, there were tears now forming in her eyes. Not ugly tears, not lovely ones, but bitter adult tears. Tears of the kind the world weeps for itself. "How? How can what you're saying be the truth?" He told her of the fountain in the woods. Those driven to despair will sometimes come across it and find themselves compelled to drink. Any who taste its waters change, perhaps to a form of chance's choosing, perhaps to those of fate. I don't know. It offers freedom of a kind, from pain, from fear and loss. But I doubt if it delivers on that offer in the end. For a moment, she paid him the respect of suspending disbelief. One of her eyebrows lifted slightly, but that was all. "I find I almost do believe you, and if I listen to my heart, I might. But it all sounds far too strange, and I cannot trust my heart in this, because it will believe any tale where Eidsworth is alive. So how do you know all this is true? How do you know that Eidsworth drank, when you did not even know her name?" "Because I've knelt where she knelt, and I felt the water in my hands." He was no longer looking at Colwyn, but over her shoulder. "Because I know what it's like to lose what makes your life worth living. And because I know what it's like to lose myself." As she turned to see what he was looking at, Colwyn saw no rose-gold glow, no dark-haired damsel with fathoms in her eyes. Only dark trees and an avenue between them, evanescent. "I won't believe this fairy tale of yours," she said. "I can't." But as she turned back to look at him, he could tell from her eyes that she already did. She had lived too long on the edges of this fog to not believe in wonders lurking further in. And her heart believed him. "I haven't come here to convince you of anything, Colwyn. I'm only here to tell the truth."
"And what about your quest, hmm?"
From the edge in her voice, he could tell she was desperate to believe him. Desperate not to believe him.
"What about 500 silver pieces in an earl's seat? Why, throw them away."
He ignored the question. He knew the answer, and that was enough.
"Will you come with me?" he said. "Will you help me try and save her?"
She stood, paralyzed.
"She remembers you, Colwyn. I think you're her only chance. Come with me. I can't save her without you."
And as she stared at him, she felt the cold weight of the locket on her chest. The one he had returned to her. And she saw the lines of trouble on his face, so much like the ones she ran her fingers across each time she gazed into a mirror. She trusted him.
"No," she said.
But then, before he could turn back, she surrendered to her heart.
"Yes. Yes. Take me to her. Help me get her back, and anything you want is yours."
Through swamps and marshes, icy, thigh-deep water and chest-high rocks, through fogs, dark reeds and darker trees, they traveled together now. They kept off roads, not wanting to be caught by Sarkwide's guards, or worse, the likes of Shaetha Ban. It was a dismal journey, but Colwyn did not complain. Though seeming frail from a year of grief, she had been raised to the backcountry and took well enough to it again. Indeed, the struggles of survival seemed to reawaken some vitality she had once known, and the colder it became, the less she shivered. He smiled to see her lively, full of life.
"That's why you came this way looking for her?"
"I was heading for Skitch Heap, the village where she was born," She nodded to the gray horizon, just over the side of these hills, on the water's edge. Water. He remembered the great swath of gray flood where he had seen the beast's slow ripple, had heard its anguished call. He had a feeling for the landscape now, and judged it was in the same direction. What's on the other side of the water? She closed her eyes, remembering afternoons climbing hand in hand over the downs with Idswith's laughter in her ears, under a pale, warm sun. Nothing much. Some low hills. Some burial mounds from long ago. Burial mounds? So they'd be hollow. She followed his thought. You think that's where she made her lair? It's warm and dark and safe and close to home. It's where I'd make my lair if I were her. She studied him. And where is home for you, Theo? Where's your lair? There was none of the ghosts teasing or prying in the question, only an earnest, well-meant curiosity that made him feel self-conscious. I've got a little place down by the sea, he said, and forged ahead before another question came. As darkness fell, they didn't risk a fire, but slept back to back for some warmth. When they woke in the morning, lying face to face, neither felt any awkwardness at all. They were human beings alone together in a great wilderness. An easy and uncomplicated bond was forming between them. They came upon Skitchheap mid-morning. In life, it must have been a dismal town. In death, it left an ugly corpse. A mere dozen homes huddled on a peninsula of flat gray mud. They had been thatch and daub and wattle before the coming of the worm. Now they were sticks and dirt and shards. A sway-backed fence of narrow pales had once been enough to keep out wild dogs, but now it was wildly strewn, and clawed footprints veered from end to end among the ruined homes, traveling amongst the wet brown bones of goats and pigs. And what had become of the people? Where was the shouting of children, the slow hum of folk about their tasks, the thoughtful silence of elders as they cooked the noonday meal? The land mourned for its emptiness, and in the muddy waste Theo could not help but see the bone-strewn flats of Heart's Desire at low tide. They did not speak together in that place. She had no desire to voice whatever thoughts assailed her. He did not desire to hear more than he saw. At the end of the headland, a few small boats lay overturned along the muddy shore. One had been crushed and carved by the lathe worm's body. The others seemed seaworthy enough. We'll come back and shelter in the village at nightfall. He unlimbered one of the boats from the gripping mud, his voice sounding loud, profane in the stillness of the town. I'd rather meet the worm by day. She didn't respond. When he glanced up at her, she was a dark shadow framed against the sky, clothes blowing, gaze distant, eyes empty with despair. And when we do find her, Theo? What then? The worm recognized you once before. Maybe she'll know you again. And then what? Her gaze focused on him, now sharpened by irony. I'll cure her with a true love's kiss? It's worth a try. He wasn't sure if he was joking. If she remembers you, maybe we can lead her back to the fountain. And if she drinks again, then maybe, if we can get her, maybe we can lead her, maybe if she drinks again. I'm as new to this as you are, Colwyn. I'm making it up as I go. And if she doesn't remember me this time? He could see the bleakness was upon her. He knew the feeling of its claws. What if she attacks me like she attacked the people here? People she knew, people she loved. Then I'll look out for you. By trying to kill her. He said nothing. And if she kills you? He said nothing. Shrugged. Why are you here? She demanded. Why is this so important to you that you'd risk your own life? And what could he say to that? How could he express the deep emotions flowing through him like spring thaw through the ancient snow? How could he tell her, in her permafrost of grief, how it felt to him like a warm wind was blowing through his life at last, like his foot was set upon the firm gravel of a sun-warmed path after so long slipping in the frozen slush? How could he say how much he longed for her to flourish, for someone in this gray world to flourish? She would take it the wrong way, think he meant some confession of love. But love, the way that people speak of love, was nothing close to what he felt. Unless we say the warming wind feels love for maple buds unfurling at the winter's end. It's important, was all he said. She stared at him, skeptical, unsettled by this drifter, tramp she did not understand. And yet, despite his sullen silences, his nightmares, and sudden starts at nothings in the fog, there was something about him that she put faith in. He had tears for the tearfulness of things. His mind could stand the touch of thoughts of death. And as she weighed his heart, she seemed, for a moment, to see a coral-colored presence standing at his shoulder, unreal against this land of endless gray. But it was nothing, after all, for then she blinked and it was gone. All right. She mustered up her courage. Let's go. Let's bring her home. And soon they were out over gray water and banked all around with fog the shade of treated bone. They'd only found one paddle in the town. She used it to steer while he rowed with a plank of splintered wood. But the water was still and light as air, and their moldering craft slid through like a cold wind through tamaracks at water's edge. They skimmed through reeds and onto open water, and the water was like volcanic glass. Iron oblations molted in its crystal depths, the gifts a long-lost nation gave their pagan gods, now lost, now gone forever. They paddled on in silence. A ghost, in saffron slippers, was dancing a gavotte across the water. "Why, look at you, a natural boatsman. One might almost think you'd been to sea." He'd seen her dance like this in life, below the orange boughs, her heels light. It felt good to be on speaking terms again, and he would have liked nothing better than to stand up and step out onto the water and take her in his arms and dance. But he kept his eyes and mind upon the task at hand. "Oh, I like it better when you're alone. You talk to me more that way." A small splash sounded in the fog. Theo flung up his hand, and Colwyn drew her paddle from the water. They drifted, silent, slow across the molten glass. "Ah, another oar?" mocked the ghost. "Was that the sound of the lathe worm's fin? Was it only in your head? You're not exactly sane, you know." But Theo didn't take her bait. The canoe flowed on in silence, leaving the ghost behind, her enigmatic laughter chiming over the fen. A few moments later, the prow ground into a sandy shore. Wordless, they disembarked among fog and broken stalks, and scrambled a gray bank where the reeds gave way to blowing grass of soft and feathered gray. "This is it," Colwyn murmured. "Can you smell it? This must be the place." The latheworm's smell was on the air, chemical, fecal, close. Now she pushed past him and took the lead, following the smell until a huge darkness yawned in the fog before them. An arch, its ancient span formed by three gray slabs half buried in the gray grass slope of a mound. And the stink of the worm was now so strong that Theo and Colwyn covered mouth and nose with sleeves. The worm's travels had left deep ruts snarled in the earth. Rusted treasures from the belly of the mound lay strewn about the entrance to the cave. Shards of bone and bits of crumpled gilt degraded in the damp. A rusted helm of bronze decayed at Theo's gentlest touch. But inside, the lair was empty. "What now?" Colwyn whispered.
"That's a good question there, Theo,"
called a voice.
"What should we be doing, eh?"
And Shaitha Ban, descended slowly from the fog. His sloped shoulders were relaxed. His big hands rested at a leather belt where iron tools hung, rust-spotted, streaked with uncleaned blood.
"Pleased to meet you, Miss Colwyn. Name a Shaitha Bane, though I dare say we'll come to know each other better soon."
He winked as two more silhouettes stepped up, crossbows easy underneath their arms. A third footstep squelched in the mud behind Colwyn and Theo. 4-on-2.
"Trying to steal a march on your old friend Shaitha Bane," the killer said, shaking his shaggy head. "Just as I feared you might, and with us being so close and all. It's a shame that puts the sadness in my heart."
Theo did his best to appear nonchalant.
"Shaitha, what a pleasant surprise."
He relaxed his body as he spoke, letting his weight drop into his legs, his hands to his left hip, ready to fight, though he knew the odds were grim.
"No sign of the worm, I take it?"
"Well, friend, it's a good news, bad news type of deal. The bad news is we've been camping here a day and a half and haven't seen hide nor hair of it. But the good news is you've brought us something even better. Isn't that right, Colwyn?"
In response, the Earl's daughter drew her knife, much to the amusement of Shaitha's men. Her eyes were very wide with fear.
"You're half right, Shaitha," Theo said, patting the pommel of his sword. "I have brought you something better than the worm."
Shaitha laughed, though his eyes remained dark, always dark.
"That's a bold thing to say, my friend. But the odds are bad for you. And you told me yourself you weren't some great swordsman. So what's the point pretending? Why not slink away and save yourself?"
At this, Theo smiled. And it seemed some reddish light reflected in his eyes.
"I don't have much to live for, Shaitha. Everyone I ever loved is dead."
He glanced at something over Shaitha's shoulder, and as the killer turned to look, a reddish glow erupted from the fog, and a black silhouette arose amidst the sanguine light. She was half-rotted, coral-robed, yellow with the staining sea, her skull a coiling iridescent nautilus with clamoring translucent things amongst her hollow eyes and slimy teeth. At the sight of her, Shaitha yelled and Colwyn screamed, and one of Shaitha's men shot useless bolts through her fleshless form. Like a goddess of the sea, she raised her pearled hand, and with a gesture came a rising wave that darkened as it grew until it hit the shore and burst, and from the wave the lathe worm howled forth. Dumbstruck, Shaitha had no time to move before the creature crashed upon him.
"Colwyn, run!"
Theo was already in motion, pivoting to his back foot, steel arcing from its sheath to shear through the man behind him. He was over the body before its comet streak of blood could hit the ground, its color startling in the grayness of the world. He could hear the worm behind him, roaring like the risen sea that tears through walls and woods and worlds and lives, unstoppable, unstopped. He ran. Crossbows snapped. Something whispered through the fog beside his ear. Something cracked against the armor of the hissing thing behind him. He heard screams and crunching flesh and his own hard pounding heart. He slipped and staggered in the wet sand. He was back at Heart's Desire when the great waves came. He was mindless with fear. He was not himself. He realized Colwyn was not beside him. And somehow he was able to gain control, wrenching himself about to face the waves. She was already half-vanished in the fog, Colwyn thin and pallid as a gold-leaved aspen against the coming storm. Behind her arched the lathe-worm's silhouetted coils, all dark, cathedral-like and rimmed with spines, all dark inside the glowering fog, except for yellow eyes which shone with fear and hate. Colwyn had her palm raised out toward it, with the undefended wrist turned up, a subtle trembling in her hand. The worm hesitated at this gesture, an oceanic rattle in its chest. It lashed its head, as if trying to clear some fog inside. Yes. She had tears in her voice. Yes, Eidsworth, it's me, Colwyn. The creature stretched toward her, its low slung jaw and scabrous face swimming from the fog like a nightmare, fish-like, reptile-like, but with the shadow of human features half buried in its disfigurement. It's me. From where Theo stood, he could not see the silver tears that shone across her face. The worm's snout came within a handbreadth of her touch. In its alien gaze, Theo thought he saw confusion, pain, and yearning. But then, a shadow stirred amongst the thorned coils of the lathe worm's bulk, and Shaitha Ban gurgled from where his body hung impaled on the creature's spikes.
Not see the last of me.
And steel flashed.
Not seen the last of Shaitha Ban.
And a knife plunged between two plates along the lathe worm's flank. The creature shrieked and thrashed, and Shaitha's guts were milked from him between the grinding coils. But Colwyn, too, was struck by the creature's lashing skull, and her body seemed to buckle at the impact, like a reed beneath the storm wind. The worm tossed back its head and howled, its cry 100 times louder than when Theo had first heard it above the fen, 1,000 times more anguished. And then the beast whirled and was gone, its huge body crashing into chill waters like a falling home. A moment later, only a wild disturbance remained upon the flood. A coil of blood, a coil of poison spreading in the wake. Theo ran to Colwyn's side, letting his sword fall to reddened sands. She was gasping and bloody, staring up at him with empty, frightened eyes. He could tell from the way she lay that her back was broken. The impact of the creature's head had crushed her ribs, and from her tattered side the blood ran dark.
I'm sorry,
she murmured over and over.
I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
But he didn't know what her apologies were for, or whom. He knelt, pressing her balled-up cloak against the rush of blood. His hands were quickly steeped. Hot tears ran down his face, and he hated himself more than even he had ever done before, for failing her. No, no, I'm the one who's sorry. It's all my fault. Oh, Colwyn, it's all my fault. But she didn't respond. Her eyelids fluttered, and he knew he was losing her. Perhaps the blow had cracked her heart. Hold on. Hold on, we'll get you help. A wild desperation came upon him, and he glanced about for some miracle, some unseen salvation from the mist. And he found the white doe. She was standing before the dark mouth of the open tomb, and the fog had grown so thick that it was only against such darkness he could see her. She looked unworldly. She was a creature of the mist itself, her eyes as dark as the tomb itself. Please. Please, you have to help her. But after a moment's further stare, the doe was gone. Staring at him? No. With a ragged epiphany, it came to him that she'd been looking past him. He turned with reckless hope, and as he did, the silver fog thinned, just long enough that he could see the wooded bluffs he'd stood upon the morning after he had first heard the worm's call. The fountain. He was already on his feet, raising the crimson wreck of Colwyn's body in his arms. He had seen the fountain's water break and remake broken bodies twice before. Just hold on, Colwyn. A little while longer, just hold on. But her breath was now almost too shallow to hear, and her face was growing pale as the damp gray sands. He ran her to the boat and laid her down on splintered timbers gently as he could. Wading waist-deep in the reeds and clinging mud, he launched, scrambling over the gunwales as the vessel veered on waters growing dim with night's approach. He dipped the oar and wrenched the vessel forward, striking the water till his breath came raw, until his body burned despite the cold. And still, it took so long to cross the water. As he paddled, he found that he was not alone. The ghost had come to him again, and sat in tranquil silence on the crossbeam of the boat. She was herself once more, dark and lovely. The blush of life was almost in her cheek. "I'm sorry," she said, glancing down at still and rain-pricked waters. "I'm sorry you couldn't save them, Theo. That you couldn't save yourself." "I haven't given up," was all he said. And after a long moment looking at him, she climbed to her feet and stepped out onto the water. "You're bearing too far north," she said. "I'll lead you by the quickest route." And other than her guiding coral glow, the fens grew dark, and all was silent but for Theo's ragged breath and Colwyn's shallow breath, and the distant keening of the worm. And still he paddled onward, as the fens grew dark.
This special series, The Hunting of the Lathe Worm, was written by Alexander Saxton and is performed by Anthony Botello. The Wrong Station is made possible with the generous support of our listeners on Patreon. Thank you to Ivan Harris and Astrid Gustafsson for helping us keep the lights, well, off. You can also support us by leaving a rating and review on iTunes, or wherever it is you listen to The Wrong Station. The Wrong Station is co-produced by Alexander Saxton, Anthony Botello, and Jacob Duarte Spiel, with music composed and performed on the piano by Alain Citrin, and arranged for the viola and performed by Viola Schmid. You can follow The Wrong Station on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and email us at thewrongstation@gmail.com. And until next time, thank you for listening.